We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. So, busy week, actually.
Yes, not supposed to be this time of year, but it was.
Mm-hmm. They snuck it in on us.
I went out, go off on vacation, and all this stuff happens.
Yeah, well, that's what they were waiting for, John.
Yeah.
All right, so...
I did pick up a nice case of Tourette's on the vacation. Want to hear?
No.
Save that for a future show. All right, so starting out with...
when KXP decides it no longer needs its license.
Labor.
Yes, lots of labor going on.
Lots of labor issues came up this week. This week, I think I mentioned it last week at the end of the show that the fast food workers strike was going to be on Thursday. And yes, indeed, on Thursday, over 50 cities saw people go out on strike from their fast food jobs to protest the low wage work that corporate America is demanding from American citizens. Now, there was a large rally downtown Seattle and one in Tacoma, too. Calling for a $15 an hour wage, minimum wage for fast food workers. Restaurant chains, of course, are trying to fight back now since these strikes appear to be growing more and more successful in more and more cities. And they're starting to launch a campaign against, talking about how, well, if we raise the minimum wage for fast food workers, there'll be fewer jobs, there'll be higher food prices, et cetera, et cetera. And they even this week came out and said, well, for every dollar that a customer spends on fast food, we'd have to raise prices by 25 cents. Well, if you think about it...
That's moronic.
If you think about it, 25 cents for every dollar you spend in a fast food restaurant, that's not a whole heck of a lot of a price increase.
Well, and now, not only that, but what that tells you is that let's say that labor costs are, let's say, 20% of McDonald's operations, which is probably high, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Then what they're saying is that if their price has to go up 25%, it means they'd have to, I'm just trying to do the quick math in my head, like quadruple the wages to get them to be, I mean, you know, 20.
Probably, yeah. But I think the real issue here is that most of these fast food restaurants are franchises, which means a local person or a local company owns the local restaurant, but they have to pay a franchise fee to the parent company. And that franchise fee determines what kind of a profit the local owner can make.
Yes.
because the franchise fee is not a small fee at all. It's a large portion of what you pay buy a hamburger, for example.
There's an upfront licensing fee, and then there's also an annual or a monthly
franchise fee.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what these smaller businesses should be doing is they should be turning around to the parent company and saying, hey, lower your franchise fees so we can afford to pay these people a living wage, because that really is what's at issue here, because the parent companies are the ones, these big corporations like McDonald's, they're the ones that are really raking in the bucks. It's not the local owners per se. It's the big parent companies. So the local owners have to band together and do essentially the same thing that their workers are doing. They have to tell these parent companies, look, lower your franchise fees. We need to pay people a livable wage. And I just want to remind folks that the federal minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. Most fast food workers do not get a full-time job from the places where they work. A lot of them work 24 to 30 hours a week and can't make a livable wage, but as Job says, they don't qualify for any kind of benefits either.
And there's a lot of PR coming out of the industry, and certainly also a lot of conservative lawmakers that put forward the sort of meme that, well, you know, it doesn't need to be a livable wage because these are teenagers on their first job or whatever. And that's, you know, anybody who's been to a fast food restaurant lately, most of those folks are not teenagers anymore. They're people with families and trying, two and three jobs trying to support themselves or themselves in a family, and you just can't do it.
In addition, a lot of older workers who have been laid off by companies who are downsizing and figure, well, I'll get rid of the folks who are over 50. A lot of those folks are having to work fast food jobs too now.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I saw a stat this week that 88% of fast food workers are over 20 years old.
So. Yeah.
And that's not evenly distributed geographically either. In a city like Seattle, that percentage is going to be higher.
Yeah.
Sorry. By the way, when they talk about having to increase food prices, the term food in there should probably be questioned too. But,
in quote.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
All right. Other labor news this week?
Yeah, and other restaurant news too. But let's get restaurant association news. But let's get to the labor first. Seattle teachers are trying to negotiate a contract with Seattle Public Schools, and by a voice vote on Sunday evening, rejected the district's initial contract offer. There's a couple three sticking points so far in the negotiations. The district is proposing to contractually increase the length of the school day for elementary school teachers from 7 to 7.5 hours. Without increasing the pay, that extra half hour is supposed to set aside go aside for teacher planning and collaboration, but there's simultaneously setting aside a weekly hour that is paid for those purposes. The district is countering by saying, well, we're going to increase the wages to offset that, the overall wages. But what they're increasing, they're offering as an increase is a 2% pay increase, each year for 2 years, which as anybody who lives in Seattle knows, is hardly enough to cover a rent increase, let alone the rest of cost of living increases. There's a couple other sticking points also, the union is objecting to requirement for both city and state teacher evaluations being tied teacher performance being contract tied to contracts. Now, when the Seattle schools signed their last contract in 2010, it was a pretty groundbreaking agreement to tie the teacher evaluations to their performance within the contract. But a couple things have happened since then. Number one, last year, because of new federal requirements, the state also adopted those requirements, and they are not the same as the city's. And so now the teachers are facing having to juggle both sets of requirements. The other thing that's happened is that we've seen, and this is what the whole MAP test boycott was about earlier this year, where the district has really been using inappropriate tools for a lot of those teacher evaluations and not being flexible enough to change them when it turns out they are inappropriate. So that, for example, one of the complaints with the MAP test that Garfield and other high school teachers were complaining about is that because it wasn't tied at all to what students were actually doing in the classroom, and because there wasn't any kind of a reward or penalty for students doing better or worse on the test, the students didn't take it seriously. They would just fill out whatever and treat it as a goof, and then teachers are evaluated based on that, and it's not a legitimate evaluation. And so the union is concerned about that, and there are a couple other lesser things. Now, the negotiations are still continuing through the week and into the weekend. There was again rallies, unfortunately, at the same time as the fast food rallies on Thursday afternoon and evening for the teachers. I think four of them in different parts of the city. And students are due back at school on Wednesday. The district is saying they think they'll get a agreement in place by them, but they've also sent out a letter to parents saying make alternative plans. So it looks like it's going to go down to the wire over the weekend, and we'll see what happens.
All right. Also this week, a big donation coming in against Initiative 522.
Yeah, Initiative 522, which is the campaign to label genetically modified food, is getting a lot of money piled into the anti-campaign.
That's a shock.
Yeah.
Same thing happened in California last year.
Yeah, the total has now come to $3,257,000 and some change. All of the anti-campaign funds are from five out-of-state sources. Bayer Crop Science, Monsanto, DuPont Pioneer, Dow AgroSciences, and the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which has given the most so far. Now, the Grocery Manufacturers Association also represents a bunch of different big food corporations, including ConAgra, General Mills, Kellogg, Hillshire Farms, PepsiCo, and Coca-Cola. Now, they keep saying, of course, that the GMO labeling campaign will increase the price of food, and that is absolutely wrong.
How?
That is wrong, because these companies routinely change their labeling to conform to federal law. Take, for example, their most recent change, which was to include allergens on the label, like wheat, dairy, soy. You know, this food may contain wheat, dairy, soy, etc. It's not going to cost them anything to add this food may contain wheat, dairy, soy, and GMOs. those.
They change their labeling whenever they want, you know, free inside coupon four or something like that. I mean, there's no cost to it at all.
There's no cost to it at all. And so the GMO labeling initiative now has record amounts of money being poured into it. And we're going to be seeing a lot of TV ads coming up in this towards November saying, oh, you know, do you want to pay more for the basics, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's just false advertising. It's just wrong.
You know, for the pro initiative campaign, I would really love them to see them come out with some kind of sarcastic ad, something like, I really don't want to know what's in my food. I'd really rather stay ignorant. That's why I'm voting no.
Right.
Speaking of food and big manufacturing associations and whatnot, we also saw the effort of the Washington Restaurant Association and Alaska Airlines and a couple of the food concessionaires at SeaTac suing successfully this week, at least so far, to keep the $15 minimum wage initiative off the ballot in the city of SeaTac in November. We had King County Superior Court Justice Andrea Davis ruling early this week that the signatures of 61 people who signed those petitions were void because they had signed them twice, and that both the original and the duplicate signatures needed to be thrown out. As a result of that, that dropped the number of valid signatures collected by the initiative sponsors below the 1,541 required to put the ballot measure on the ballot. Now, they had turned in over 2,500 signatures. Normally, the rule of thumb for signatures for initiative drives is, well, you want to add a padding of 30% to 40%. This was a 60% padding, but the lawyers, excuse me, for the Restaurant Association and Alaska Airlines and these other groups have been very, very aggressive in trying to get the court to throw out these different signatures, and they've been successful. Now, the initiative sponsors, on the other hand, claim that there's a grace period of 10 days in which they can amend their initial petition by submitting additional signatures, and they have done that. They added another 250 signatures, and so now the judge needs to go back and rule as to whether those additional signatures will be valid or not. That ruling is going to determine whether the $15 minimum wage measure that the SeaTac City Council put on the ballot in November will in fact appear there.
All right. On to developments with the 520 bridge.
Yeah, we found out this week the State Department of Transportation announced that, yes, they believe the 520 bridge is going to go over budget. Now, it's been having problems, design problems.
They just kind of floated that out there, huh?
Oh, yeah, they did just kind of float that out there along with the cracked pontoons. The design problems involving the pontoons, which are cracking and which they are trying to repair. In order to save money, the State Department of Transportation engineers decided they would do the design in-house, and instead of doing a full design of the pontoons, they took the pontoons of a smaller bridge and just scaled them up without doing any kind of stress testing at all. And that, of course, has led to problems with just casting the pontoons, just casting them and floating them out there. They've developed cracks and have leaked. And they've had to go back to dry dock and the cracks have been filled with epoxy, and they've had to put steel tension around them to try to bind the pontoons together. Sounds a little dicey to me. I don't know if I'm going to be wanting to go across that bridge once it's finished, but that's apparently what half of the pontoons are going to be. Now, that has taken up a lot of money. First, they said it was only going to take a part of the reserve funds to pay for the repairs, but with the repairs only partially over, now they're saying that they have used up, they're going to be using up all of the reserve funds on the entire project. Plus, it's going to cost an extra $128 million to fix those pontoons. So it's already looking like it's going to be over budget. And I just want to point out that, remember, there's a large chunk of the bridge that's bridge financing that still has not been figured out.
Yeah, all the area on the west side, the part approaching the
Mall
like that.
And that's going to cost about $1.5 billion, and the state still has not come up with how they're going to get the money to pay for that. So in addition to that $1.5 billion, there's now at least $128 million
There's some city funding for the mitigation efforts around the Arboretum and the approach on the west side that has not been covered either.
Right.
So I think both of you were around here in these days, and I am, so we're all going to be dating ourselves here. But in 1990, way back in 1990, they were building a new floating bridge to for the second side on I-90 going across to Mercer Island. You know where I'm going with this, don't you?
I do. Go ahead.
It sank. The bridge sank before they opened it. Does history repeat itself?
I know. I know. And here,
it's sure sounding like it's going that direction.
Yeah, and here, you know, state legislators, especially the Republicans, like to cry about spending money on transit and how transit is a big boondoggle and they always go over budget, yada, yada, yada. This is not spending on transit. This is spending on a big highway project that should have been done a lot better and should have come in at least on budget, even if a large chunk of the budget still hasn't been figured out how they're going to get it. In the case of this bridge, it's now more than a year, going to be more than a year late in opening. The target is now April 2016, which I think is about a year and 4 months after they initially thought they'd be able to open it.
But fortunately, there's no chance of cost overruns with the downtown tunnel. Never happen.
Moving on. Maybe the people that designed all these were smoking something. And this week, the Department of Justice said they're going to back off on
allowing people here in the state to smoke something. Yeah. The Department of Justice issued their new policy this week on state laws regarding the recreational and medical use of marijuana. They said that basically it'll be okay to let people grow it, sell it, and buy it as long as the states tightly regulate how that all of that is done in order to keep it out of the hands of kids and away from where kids assemble, you know, like schools.
Which is consistent with the state laws.
Yeah, and to keep it off federal property and away from known drug traffickers and folks who deal other kinds of controlled substances. So They would also like to keep marijuana from being shipped across state lines from our state into, say, Idaho, where it's not considered legal for people to use it recreationally. They also said that states need to make sure that people do not drive while intoxicated, which, of course, is also addressed by our state law. So this is all pretty good
news for us. It's badly addressed by the state law because their standard for intoxication is totally inappropriate. But it is addressed.
But it is good news.
It's mostly good news. Mm-hmm. There's a significant caveat in terms of something that they did not address. And people in the medical and recreational marijuana advocacy community are saying that behind the scenes there's some discussion going on, so they're hopeful that it will be addressed at some point. Mm-hmm. But anybody who wants to get in on the distribution of marijuana, particularly setting up businesses, and people who have done the medical marijuana shops have run into this already, because of federal regulations, it's almost impossible to get banking services. Yeah. You can't get loans for your business. You can't even get a simple checking account or credit card because of the federal prohibitions on laundering drug money.
Yeah.
And, you know, for their In order to have a regulated system that gets marijuana distribution out of the black market, you have to have legitimate businesses being able to deal in it, and that was not addressed by the DOJ regulations.
Exactly. Yeah, and the fact that they didn't address the banking issues involved means that the only people who can really afford to set up big, larger grow operations and distribution means people who have lots of cash, and that means a lot of involvement from, you guessed it, the black market.
All right. Also this week, a big decision coming out of the IRS.
Yeah, the IRS, that is the Treasury Department, announced this week that same-sex couples who have legally married can now file joint tax returns beginning with the 2013 tax year.
And that's legally married even if it's not in the state where they actually reside.
Right. So it doesn't depend on where their state of residence is. What it depends on is if you went to a state where marriage is where gay marriage is legal and you got legally married there. Doesn't matter where you reside, you will be able to file married filing jointly. And if you don't file as married filing jointly, you will have to file as married filing separately. You can no longer file as a single taxpayer.
Now, did they say how they would handle that? Because unlike Washington State, most states do have state income taxes as well.
It's going to be messy.
And so how do you handle federal income tax credit on state tax returns when in the states they cannot file as a married couple.
Well, it's going to
– So it's a different rate.
It's going to be – yeah, it's going to be messy because a lot of the states take the federal taxable income as their starting point when they calculate state tax. And, you know, if your federal taxable income is based on married filing jointly, but the state doesn't recognize your marriage, well, I think you're going to have to go back, do a whole nother calculation as if single, and then do it that way for state purposes. And I think it's going to give the states a push to start to recognize legal marriages in other states, even if they don't allow same-sex marriage in their own state.
Yeah, try telling that to legislators in Alabama or Kansas. I don't think it's going to happen.
I know. It's going to be messy until it gets all sorted out.
All right. And further developments this week in regards to the NSA and surveillance.
Yeah, Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower, gave some more information to the Washington Post this week. He gave them the black budget for 2013. Now, the black budget refers to the budget request made, the secret budget request made to Congress for money for all of the some 26 intelligence services that are run by the U.S. government. Now, usually the black budget is secret, and we have not seen, the American people have not seen one for a long time.
Church Committee, mid-70s,
I think was the last time. Yeah, mid-70s, I think was the last time. This time around, the Washington Post actually censored most of the detail, self-censored most of the detail, but they still released what appears to be an unprecedented amount of info. For example, the CIA is at the top of the list of all 26 agencies with a budget of $14.7 billion for 2013. What does that $14.7 billion pay for? Well, you and I can probably figure that out. Secret prisons, for example, the torture interrogation program, the drones that have been deployed in places like Pakistan, Yemen, all over Africa.
CIA really isn't in the business of intelligence anymore. It's now an active military operation, and the intelligence gathering has gone back to the DIA and NSA.
Yeah. Now, there's a line item in the CIA's budget called their covert action program line that is $2.6 billion. But I'm guessing that there are actually other line items that may also contribute to the CIA's actual covert actions around the world. Now, the overall budget had five priorities. The top one, of course, was anti-terrorism, got the bulk of the money. But the other goals included to stop nuclear proliferation, to engage in intelligence collection regarding critical foreign events in order to keep our government apprised of what's going on around the world, defending against foreign espionage, and, of course, a new priority, which is cyber operations, particularly cyber offensive operations, which are being undertaken by the CIA, the NSA, and the militaries.
Even though we would never, ever, ever actually do
intelligence
that.
Intelligence agencies.
Stuxnet.
Right. over the last decade, the budget has seen double-digit increases every year. It is now double what it once was in 2001. And we know that because the top line number has been released each year by Congress, but not any of the details.
And I'm guessing they're not too worried about the sequester either.
No, they're not. In fact, the budget is slightly smaller from 2012, but not as much as it is for other agencies in the federal government. In fact, most of the funding for the CIA, for example, is exactly the same this year as it was last year.
Yeah, I see where the Washington Post also had an article this week about the U.S. spy agencies mounted 231 offensive cyber operations in 2011.
Yeah, so that's amazing.
And that went up last year, almost certainly.
That, oh, no, that
example,
is
example that would be
definitely
like Stuxnet.
That is definitely the growing portion of the budget.
All right. That leaves us just about 5 minutes to talk about Syria.
To start? Since we went on the air a half hour ago, there may be missiles flying. Maria, I don't know how much you talked about this last week. The whole idea that there was a chemical attack in Seattle on
Syria.
Well, there's one in Seattle too. Just ask SPD. But we're talking about the one in Syria on August 21st, and a number of people died. And the fact that there was some sort of a chemical attack is pretty well verified at this point. We don't know a lot of the details yet about what kind of agent and delivery systems and things like that. But there's a lot of pretty compelling evidence. What there is not clear evidence about is who is responsible. The United States government is trying to make a very compelling case that they believe the Assad government was behind it. There's a lot of questions about that, though. The UN inspectors on the ground have not completed their investigation yet. And the gist of the Obama administration's case is, we know the Assad government had the opportunity, and we know they have the weapons. Therefore, they must have been the ones behind it because nobody else could have done it.
However, there was a New York Times article this week asking why would Assad do this, particularly when he has UN inspectors already in the country checking into previous potential chemical weapons attacks.
They literally landed on the day before the August 21st attacks.
And I'm just going to read it.
In the suburbs of Damascus, which is one of the Assad area's strongest areas. If this were a murder investigation, you would look at motive and say this doesn't add up.
Right, right.
And you would look at the rest of it as circumstantial evidence.
Yeah, and so I'm just going to read a sentence from that article. And the sentence goes like this. Evidence from videos and witnesses suggested that the toxic substances in last week's attack were delivered by improvised tube-launched missiles that could be used by smaller, more mobile units than were thought to be needed for chemical weapons. That's fact, folks. I mean, John Kerry gave a speech this week saying these are the facts that we know. Well, this is a fact he didn't mention, that the Syrian government has chemical weapons, but the weapons that were actually used were not standard military issue. They were improvised tube-launched missiles, which could be deployed by any small unit on the battlefield. And last week I talked about how it's not a black-and-white battlefield in Syria. You got multiple players.
A lot of paramilitary groups on both sides.
Militias on both sides that are not controlled by the Syrian government or the Free Syrian Army. And you have a lot of criminal gangs that can get a hold of black market weapons and are supplying weapons to both sides because of various weapons embargoes. So it's not clear who
and
deploy
when,
the weapons.
When the Cameron government was trying to make the case for this using basically the U.S. evidence to the U.K. Parliament yesterday, they were very, very skeptical, much more skeptical than you're hearing in U.S. media or from Congress. But instead, the Obama administration appears to be intent on going ahead, as I said, pretty much at any moment. They're doing so without any legal authorization from Congress, from the UN, from the Security Council or General Assembly, from NATO. The Arab League is very much against this. So the precedent of doing this without any kind of legal justification at all is a very, very bad precedent.
It's the Bush administration's decision to invade Iraq on faulty evidence. But that's the precedent.
Well, yes, except that the Bush administration at least made an attempt to round up allies and an attempt to go through the United Nations.
And an attempt to give us evidence, which we haven't seen at all.
Yeah, and we're not even seeing any of that. And so, if you trust President Obama because he's a good guy and he won the Nobel Peace Prize, just think of the precedent this sets for the next Democratic or Republican president, President Armed Services Committee, Madam E.S. Hillary Clinton. Uh-huh. It's very, very worrisome on that score. It's very worrisome on the score of there should be an international response if chemical weapons have been used, not a United States response.
And the UN inspector should be allowed the extra 3 days to a week that they need to finish their investigation and prepare the actual report of what they think happened.
I mean, we're getting an execution of a sentence here and a decision of a sentence before the trial has even taken place.
Yeah.
It really is backward. And then there's the issue of, who should be judging it and who should be carrying out the sentence. And it shouldn't be the United States government unilaterally. So there's a lot of concerns about the why of this. But there's also the geopolitical concerns about the end game. Because once the United States is involved in this, it's sort of a you break it, you own it kind of thing. And there are no good guys in this situation.
Yeah. In addition, we kind of gave Syria, if you think about it, we kind of gave Syria the go-ahead by rewarding the Egyptian military for having slaughtered precisely the same number of people just a week before in Cairo when they slaughtered defenseless people in the street.
And this is the final concern, which is that the hypocrisy of the United States, very much seen in the Arab world. It's why the Arab League is so strongly against this. where the United States really stood by when a similar number of people were slaughtered with U.S. weapons in the streets mm-hmm. of Cairo earlier this month. It's very much a double standard and concerning a lot of people not in this
very
country.
Very much why we have to have international support.
So today there is going to be an emergency rally trying to express people's concerns against a military strike. Against Syria, against somebody in Syria anyway, probably civilians. But anyway, so that's going to be at the Federal Building at 2nd between Marion and Madison, downtown Seattle, starting at noon today. And it should be a nice, warm, sunny day. So go on down there and make your voice heard. Noon today.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.